Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Along with me this evening is Tony Gosling out of New Zealand. Welcome back to our program, Tony Gosling.
Hi, George. I'm on holiday at the moment in New Zealand, and I've just been to the South Island, and back in the North Island now. You know, it has to say something about this place, because it is a little bit of a strange blend of the United States and Britain. So people drive on the left, but actually, all the roads look like, and the road signs look like US road signs. So it's a bit confusing for us Brits as to where we actually are when we're here. So, I mean, yeah, it's been fascinating as well just chatting to people. They seem to have a lot of leisure time. And also, there's still very much that kind of pioneer.
Yeah, that island up there is beautiful, isn't it? North Island. Yeah.
It's fantastic, really amazing. And also the relations with the indigenous people are pretty good. I mean, you know, of course you always see a certain sort of marginalised type of the Maoris, but it seems that because of the good employment situation here, the fact that it's very easy to get somewhere to live, it's very cheap to get somewhere to live, that sort of thing, makes it a lot easier for poorer people to just carry on and survive as normal. And once they get a job, of course, that means they can then get all the greater things in life, like, you know, get a car or that sort of thing. And life here is pretty easy, George.
Well, it sounds like a beautiful place to live. You're not going to move down there, are you?
Well, of course I'm tempted, but no. No, because my work is in the UK, but it's nice to be able to come out and visit family out here, as I try and do every year or every couple of years. It's got that very English feel to it. Actually, quite a lot of the facilities that used to be there in Britain 30, 40 years ago, before factories and before privatisation, you know, the community facilities, all the libraries, this sort of thing, telephone boxes even still here, you know, before the age of the mobile. It's almost like you're taking a trip back in time, George, to a sort of 1950s or 60s Britain. And the reason I say that is because I've just been driving along near Auckland, and there's an event taking place with all these old British cars. And I was absolutely staggered to see the number of cars from the 1960s and 1970s that are still here, and all these British-made cars. And of course, there really aren't any proper British-made cars anymore, even though some cars are made in Britain. They're not actually British, so they're, you know, owned by foreign companies. Whereas these are all the old Austin, Morris, Rover, Triumph, these old cars that sort of conked out after we joined the European Economic Community in the 1970s. So by 1980, pretty much, these kinds of cars were winding down and the factories were closed, or they were being bought by big German concerns like BMW.
Okay, boy, that's very interesting then, isn't it, huh?
Well, I mean, for me, it is. I mean, it's interesting that the people here still feel a very strong connection with the UK. Even though, of course, they're, you know, the quite opposite side of the planet, there's a lot of Englishness here, and a lot of people have come over here over the last, you know, whatever it is, 150 years or so, from Britain. So it's got a very British feel to it, and it's actually quite a nice British feel, rather than today, which is a, you know, we've got all these northern cities in the UK which have really lost their purpose for being, you know, where they were industrial cities, and now the industry is all gone to other parts of Europe.
Oh, man. Well, we've got a lot to talk about tonight, Tony. There's a lot going on, isn't there, in the world?
Well, there certainly is. And one person I'd like to mention right at the start is, and this is one of the things that I like to do in journalism, is to pull out people who are like absolute diamonds out there.
Yes.
We call them diamonds in the cesspool, because there's so much dreadful media and bad reporting by the big networks. But this guy, Michael Tyler, he's a software engineer. He found it very difficult to get work. He's now got some work, but he's living on a canal boat near Northampton. And he has done this amazing job with no one else on the planet, not even the big multi-billion dollar funded media has done. And he's done a thorough investigation into the deaths of bankers over the last 3 or 4 years, and he's just done an update on his list for 2018. So he's michaeltyler.co.uk.
Okay.
One of the things Michael said, George, and I really recommend people have a look at this site, is that because he's a software engineer, he notices things that people might not otherwise notice. That is to say, Google changed its algorithm end of last April for several weeks, several months, and it's changing bit by bit the way it operates. You know, so over a period of months, you'll find different search will produce different results. But Google are making no announcements that the algorithm is being ramped up or ramped down or changed or whatever. So you're dealing with this kind of movable secret, movable feast when it comes to the Google algorithm. And what he's pointed out is he's saying that Google have now got what they call an alternative media off button. So his website was completely listed off the website, so off the search. So Google weren't listing him at all last May. So you could search for his website all you wanted to, but he disappeared from the results.
Oh, my gosh.
He's now back on with his list of all the dead bankers, etc. And the detail, the thing is, he's got links to almost all the press articles about all these various dead bankers. He's done a fantastic job, and yet nobody, you know, when I interviewed him, he was saying, Tony, you're the first person to ever interview me. No media has ever interviewed me before. He said, I've just put this up on my blog. So what he said is that the alternative media off button is now being prepared at Google. So he's saying that, look, when they tried this out, they tried it out for a few weeks, a few months last year, and now everything's back to normal, supposedly, in Google, at least it is with regard to his own website. His statistics are coming back up again. But he's saying what they've done is they've developed what they call an alternative media off button for the forthcoming war. He points out that the Syrians have got this kind of thing, the Russians have got this kind of thing, and now the United States and Europe have got this with Google too. So at any point that there's some kind of international conflict, and the mainstream corporate media is what the powers that be, the deep state, want us to be watching and listening, that Google is now in a position to be able to switch off all reference to the alternative media, which is, you know, pretty scary, really. So Michael's done, I think, a fantastic job there writing that article, Google's alternative media off button, ready for the forthcoming war. And he's done a big picture of an off switch, you know.
Yeah.
You get on your light bulb, you know, so you can just switch it off. He can switch everybody off. Google can now do that.
Yeah, they can do that. They own that infrastructure and control it. So that's the ultimate censorship switch.
As a software engineer, he's just putting forward the case and showing the evidence that this is what Google were doing last April, last May.
Well, what they've done, I believe, is that instead of cutting people off entirely, and they've done that too, they're using all of these algorithms and isolating people and banning people very on different levels. You know, it's
that's
sophisticated.
Right. Exactly. Burying people, sort of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 pages in, you know, that sort of thing. So it's quite clear that there are serious preparations by the tech giants for
right.
a war, a massive, you know, I would say potentially a world war. This is what they're looking to make sure that they can spin that in whatever direction they want and lie to the hundreds of millions of people watching and listening around the Western world about what's happening. You know, we also saw this interesting economic blip, didn't we, a couple of weeks ago, which I've been looking at a bit more closely. I don't know, Mervyn King was commenting on it, and I was just looking at the amount of money. He's saying £166 trillion. Now, I'm not sure how that makes in dollars, but we've got a bubble about to burst. And this is the former governor of the Bank of England making it absolutely clear that there is a warning of an imminent crash. Now, he's not talking about bailouts. He's talking about a crash of a stock market bubble. And that's the biggest in history, George. £166 billion bubble is going to go bang in quite a big way. And that, you know, that I think fascinating. Another story which has just come up since I last spoke to you was all this stuff about the Freemasons. Now, this has been massive in Britain, being covered in most of the main newspapers, And, I mean, this doesn't happen too often, does it, George?
No, it doesn't. It's not talked about very much, is it?
No, and although I think probably there's maybe more discussion about it in the US than in the UK, the interesting thing is that The Guardian has done a series of articles about these two Freemasons' lodges in the Houses of Parliament. I don't know if you've come across this, George.
Right. You know,
amongst members of Parliament who are in one of the lodges, which is called the New Welcome Lodge, and also the what they call lobby journalists. They are the journalists that cover the day-to-day running of Parliament in the, what they call the Gallery Lodge. So we've got two lodges, and they even talk about one of the journalists arriving one day in the Parliament.
What's
room where the journalists operate from, to find all the chairs arranged in a very strange manner, and then to be told, oh well, that's because the Freemasons have been in here, you know, this kind of thing. But this, for this to be out in the national press and discussed nationally in most of the papers, and also statements being made by the journalists union, my journalists union for example,
yeah,
about the fact that there is not compatible with journalism, secret membership of secret societies. It's nice to see my general secretary, Michelle Sanistry, actually making public statements right across the UK saying, no, this is not compatible with open journalism. And even the Church of England is also saying that it's feasible, anyway, I think they've taken one step back from saying 100%, but they're saying also that it's very unlikely that Freemasonry is compatible with Christianity. That's the Church of England saying that. So it's caused a bit of a furore, and even, for example, statements saying that, for example, secret Freemasons should have no place in public life. That's a Guardian article from the 5th of February. You know, this is really good that this sort of thing is being discussed, because at the end of it all, just about two or three days ago, there was an article about the Illuminati in The Guardian, if you can believe that, George.
Right. Boy, that's really, you know, we look at The Guardian and Independent sometimes because our newspapers don't measure up to them in exposing things like this sometimes.
Well,
we just don't have the same newspapers here.
The Guardian, for a long time, has been quite a good left-wing newspaper. That's okay if you're left-wing. For me, I'm not really left-wing or right-wing. I would say, from a very general point of view, probably more left-wing than right-wing. I think that government should have a great deal of control over the infrastructure of the country to make sure that it's not in the hands of private businesses. That is to say, the real backbone of the country, things like the electricity supply, the water supply, the things that everybody needs and that are natural monopolies, should be managed and run openly, with meetings of the boards all open to members of the public to come along. That's the way it should be run, and it should not be run for profit. It should be run at cost as a benefit to the whole community. But to that extent, I am left wing. But I don't believe that everything should be like a Soviet system, you know, taken over by the government at all. And I do believe that we need regulation as private, particularly big private corporations, things like the oil industry. I think the Guardian is a left-wing paper, so I would disagree with it on, you know, some things as well, though. Because, for example, all this stuff about gun control in the United States, you'll find almost every single left-wing person will be saying, oh, we should just stop everyone having guns. Well, I don't necessarily believe that. I think, you know, one of the foundations of the United States was the idea of stopping the government having a monopoly on weapons, and that was one of the things that
these tyrannies have a monopoly on weapons. That's the most tyrannical governments in the world kill their people.
Everybody should do a bit of what I do, not necessarily to the same extent as me, obviously, but have one foot in the left camp and one foot in the right camp. So don't decide you have to be a left-wing person or a right-wing person.
Right.
Take some views from each side, depending on what your conscience tells you, you know, because the idea is that left and right, I think, is just used to divide and rule. But look, let me come back to this Illuminati article, because I've never really seen anything like it. any national newspaper in the United States, or let alone in the UK. And what they're really saying in the article is, I think, a fantastic piece of work, really. The headline is, "Does the Illuminati control the world? Maybe it's not such a mad idea." That's in the Guardian. He's the journalist named Julian Baggini, questioning the hidden power of elites, he says, whether big pharmaceutical or big secret societies, is really quite sane. You know, this is the sort of stuff I'm quite surprised to see, you know, that the Guardian doing.
Well, it's you know, synergy was that idea coming out of France in the 17th.
Right.
What's that?
That's right. Yes, I agree. Yes.
So what they're trying to do is reintroduce that idea into, it's okay for the secret societies to be behind the scenes and run everything. That's okay. See?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is a brilliant article, George, and it's really lovely to see it in the National Press. He finishes the article. He calls himself a philosopher. And he finishes the article off. So I always think the most important bit is the first line and the last line of the article. So the final line is, "When we dig for the truth, we flirt with madness," he says. "But in a world where hidden power is all too real, it's the only sane thing to do." He's really saying, "When we dig for the truth, we flirt with madness."
Yeah.
"But in a world where hidden power is all too real, it's the only sane thing to do." So he's really pointing to the fact that we're now living in a world, particularly here in the West, where much of the power, like the Wizard of Oz, is hidden behind the curtain.
Yeah, like the Wizard of Oz, You know, the thing is, the real powers have to hide the power system and the structure to maintain that power system. That's what they're doing.
Yeah, they certainly have. I mean, the thing is, I think from time to time, like after the Second World War, maybe in the 1960s, 1970s, we had a bit more relaxation of that power, so people were able to more do what they wanted to. Since then, it's become more and more difficult for people to actually make their own way in the world.
Yeah.
And the secret societies, maybe even better to call them just secret interests, that is to say, business interests getting together quietly behind the scenes, have become much, much more powerful, both in our politics and in our media. These are the two key areas. If democracy is going to survive, you need to have freedom in political parties to say and think what you want, freedom of conscience, and also you need to have free journalism. You need to have, you know, whether it's books, magazines, radio, television, newspapers, whatever, you need to have a plurality. And what's happened is the opposite. Big boys like Murdoch have been buying everybody up. All the small guys, the small publishers, the small magazines, have been being basically sucked up by these massive mega corporations, who, by the way, have almost all got their investments in tax havens. You look at people like the people that run the Daily Mail and General Trust, the Daily Mail people, their money is squirreled away in places like Jersey. They don't pay any tax, George. But even some of the senior BBC people have been being paid through offshore companies on these dodgy tax deals. So the media is absolutely embedded with this whole idea of tax avoidance. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that they're so biased nowadays. Anyway, look, maybe we also ought to talk about this South Florida shooting, George, because that was pretty horrific, wasn't it?
Yeah, sounds good. How about Assange, Julian? Is he going to ever get out of England?
We'll talk about him first, I mean, we've had a court case this week with Assange.
Right.
I mean, unbelievable, really, that he's still in this the Ecuadorian
embassy.
So it's just putting in perspective, Julian Assange is the most important radical anti-war, anti-war crime publisher in the world.
Right.
And rather than embracing this whole idea of publishing and stopping wars by brave and courageous journalism, what has the British government done? Well, it's incarcerated him under house arrest. So he can operate, but he's really locked up in that place. And Craig Murray, who's a former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, is also a terrific writer and speaker, probably one of the best bloggers in the world. He blogs at craigmurray.org.uk, has pointed out that the judge who dismissed Julian Assange's case this week was Lady Arbuthnot of Edrom, wife to the Tory peer, former junior defence minister and government whip, Lord James Arbuthnot. He's also chairman of the Conservative Friends of Israel. Eton educated, the son of Major Sir John Sinclair Arbuthnot. I mean, this is absolutely disgusting. Someone with so much important ties, number one to the Zionists and number two to the Tories, should be adjudicating on the Julian Assange's case. And if you look it up, you'll find that this Lady Arbuthnot, what's her name, Emma Arbuthnot, is a senior judge, and she's actually more, I think, a Tory, doing the work of the establishment than she is in any way. In fact, if it was me, and this might sound a little bit crazy, George, I would not accept her as someone to be in any way involved in any case that was a political case, because she's got such strong links, number one to the Israel lobby, and number two to the Conservative Party. So it's pretty clear that the judicial system is being abused by people like this in order to keep Assange incarcerated.
Well, you know, the Jerome Corsi is saying that they believe that that Trump is trying to get Assange out, but the British are stopping it, see, because Assange is revealing the deep state, whether it's in England or the United States.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I'm not sure what Jerome Corsi's sources are on that.
Well, he's been getting this QAnon. You know QAnon?
Yeah.
He's been getting
this, yeah.
Well, he's been getting intelligence from him.
This is an anonymous source.
Yeah.
Right, so it could be disinformation as well.
I know, but some of it is pretty good. Some of it's pretty good, you know. It looks pretty good to me, some of it.
Anyone that's, any source like that, you've got to be a bit careful on.
Yeah, I know. You know that.
They could be feeding you three fantastic, beautiful fried trout and then one rotten old mackerel, yeah?
Oh,
so
one thing.
Quite sure.
Yeah, one thing.
I'm not quite sure what they're up to.
Yeah, one thing I didn't want to miss this week is Robert Perry. I 2 weeks ago when we had our last conversation, it didn't occur to me that he had Consortium News, and he's the one that outed that attack over there in Syria and tied it back to the Israelis and the Saudis, I believe. You remember?
Yeah, he's one of the best people.
And now he's gone. Those kind of good people, man.
That's right. I mean, he's one of those very rare journalists who's been right at the top of the mainstream game.
Yeah, he was.
He was working for the Associated Press. And he, as a result of all that, he's got all the contacts.
Right.
You know? He's very much like Seymour Hersh. Someone like Seymour Hersh, he has got real top contacts.
Seymour Hersh, you know that copper green that I was telling you about?
Yeah.
That's very important, and he wrote an article years ago on that. Seymour Hersh did. You might Google
that's
that.
Right. Well, I mean, the problem is, George, we've got less and less people like Parry around.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, I don't want to be the timing of this. I don't know whether this is whether there's anything suspicious about Parry's death. But he's right. We're right in the middle of what looks like a revival of the attempt to fit up President Assad with these chemical weapons charges, which are, you know, when it happens, you'll find it for like 48 hours, 36 hours, every single channel, they'll be saying, oh, Assad has used chemical weapons, Assad has used chemical weapons. The thing is, I don't really think many of the viewers believe it anymore, and the listeners believe it, George, because of the whole Saddam thing, because of what happened in Ghouta, and because of people like Robert Parry's brilliant work in exposing the various flaws in the evidence to pin this on Assad, not least of which is he's got no incentive to use this at all in warfare because he's winning the war.
Right.
Why would you use such an extreme weapon?
No, he wouldn't.
That if you were about to lose. So, you know, never mind the actual physical evidence, the circumstantial evidence is against it too, but yet the mainstream media just churns it out, just like they did with Iraq and WMD in Iraq.
Well, right now, Syria has so many players in there that it's a very difficult situation to resolve, I think. It's getting really dangerous in there now for everybody. You know?
Well, we saw, didn't we, last week, we saw this attack by the U.S. and the Israelis as well, which Putin had to phone up Netanyahu and get him to stop attacking Syria, because allegedly up to 100 Russian mercenaries were killed by the Israelis. So this is starting to become the obvious powder keg for a third world war. They're convinced that Iran is effectively, I mean, all they seem to do is get mixed up between what countries they're most worried about. They want to attack Iran, but they don't have any reason to. So they try and attack Iran via Syria, by attacking Syria. Attacking Iran.
Yeah.
So they're getting very, very desperate to get this war started. There's two big reasons for that. One is what I first mentioned, it's Mervyn King. And he's the former Bank of England governor, and he's warning about an enormous crash coming. Excuse me. And so there's that, which is one thing. The other thing is the various indictments that there are now on Benjamin Netanyahu. So just think about what's going to happen if he has to go to court. So this is one of the things I find so fascinating about psychological.
Well, I think, Tony, he got too friendly with Trump. And that's why they're after him with those indictments.
No, I don't. Well, I'll just have to disagree with you on that. I think. Okay, so the deep state wants rid of Trump. Absolutely clear. Everything that's happened so far points to that. He doesn't want a massive war. He thinks he's running the country, and he doesn't really understand necessarily the power of the generals or the power of the Pentagon.
The neocons are still in there surrounding him. That's a problem.
Of course they are.
Yeah.
But you see, what's happened is, they're trying to have a go at Trump through various legal means, Robert Mueller obviously being the main person behind all that. And actually the real evidence against the head of state is the evidence against Netanyahu, the bribery allegations and evidence over in Israel. Now, I have noticed around about Christmas time that there were all these demonstrations taking place over in Israel, but we haven't been told about them over here against Netanyahu. Do you see demonstrations against Donald Trump every week outside the White House, George?
What kind of demonstrations you're saying?
Yeah, saying that he should be impeached.
Well, you know, this thing that came out today.
The answer is no. There are much bigger demonstrations of ordinary people coming out.
Well, his popularity is actually, his popularity is growing. Trump nationwide is becoming more popular with the public at large. His tax thing is popular, and he's gathering his, and even in the polls that they're putting out, they're showing that he's increasing in popularity. And this indictment today, these 16 indictments are actually favorable to him. See.
Yeah, but remember, Mueller is the person behind the escape of the Saudi people who were connected to Bin Laden directly after 9/11.
Right.
He was also the boss of John O'Neill, who's the deputy director of the FBI,
yes,
who several months before 9/11 was asking to have permission to go after Bin Laden and with a whole team of FBI agents, and Mueller blocked that. So Mueller is complicit with the 9/11 cover-up before and after. He should not be in any kind of public office. The guy should be behind bars as a terrorist. He hasn't actually pressed the button himself. But what he's done is Mueller has allowed the terrorists before 9/11 to get ready to be preparing the attack in the U.S. beforehand. And then, immediately after the attack, aiding them to escape the U.S. So this guy needs to be behind bars. Anybody, what annoys me, it's a bit like the Julian Assange thing, actually, is that the mainstream press does not look into and touch any of this. None of it is really being, have you seen this on CNN, all the background on Mueller and his connection with 9/11?
The what now? Say again?
Have you seen any of this on CNN? Looking into Mueller.
Well,
CNN
is deep state captured.
Yeah.
They're not even
absolutely
halfway decent. No, really, CNN is not reliable or credible.
Well, I tell you what, you say that, and I'd agree with you mostly, but there was a terrific interview on there, actually.
Yeah, I know, they get some things right, but overall, they're acting, working for the deep state and all that. They're not really on the right side, Tony.
Well, I agree with you, but every now and again, they have a really good interview, and I just happened to be watching the other day, when I saw a terrific interview with a guy that's just written a book about the Israeli Secret Service assassination techniques. The book is called Rise and Kill First.
Okay.
It's by a guy called Ronan Bergman. He lives in Tel Aviv, and he's a freelance journalist. And this is his kind of first major work. So I'm looking forward to this guy producing lots more interesting books. So the subtitle, the main title of the book is Rise and Kill First. The subtitle is The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassination. Now, he was on CNN just a couple of days ago, and he was chatting about this book. I thought, this is great stuff. Well done, CNN. Maybe they just put him on by accident. But anyhow, he was explaining that this phrase, Rise and Kill First, which he's put in his book, is all to do with the official Israeli Defense Force policy. So if you think that there might be a conflict coming soon, what you do is you find the people who will be the leaders of the opposition to you, the enemy, in that conflict, and you go and kill them.
So that
is what they're actually up to. So what they're doing is identifying potential future rivals and murdering them, assassinating them. An assassination is a political murder. So that's the actual official Israeli government policy, the Israeli Defense Force policy, rise and kill first. The other thing he said was that this is actually from the Babylonian Talmud. And so this is something that a lot of people don't realize, that the Talmud is the rabbinic interpretation of the Old Testament for Judaism, for the Jews. But there are really two competing Talmuds. There's this Babylonian Talmud, which was when the Jews were captive in Babylon. And then there's the Jerusalem Talmud, which is the proper, original, authentic Talmud. And they've taken this, Netanyahu have taken this, and his defense people, Zippy Livni and the rest, from the Babylonian Talmud. So one can see exactly what's going on over in Israel. You've got a state which is not based on proper...
Well, you know, the Nazi...
It's based on the Babylonian corruption.
Right, exactly. The Nazi, who was the head of the Sanhedrin Council at the time of Jesus, was Hillel the Babylonian, about 30 years before Christ, Jesus. So right there, Hillel the Babylonian will tell you what the orientation was of the Sanhedrin Council at the time of Christ, right there, before his demise.
And
Christ was in opposition to the money changers, so it was the big money changers and those money people that came out against him too, you know.
So anyway, I would just recommend all your listeners get hold of a copy of this Rise and Kill First, because what he's done is he's got loads of inside sources.
Oh yeah, I've got a request in to interview him.
That will be fascinating to hear.
Yeah. I've communicated
also,
with him.
Keep an eye on Ronan Bergman, R-O-N-E-N, not R-O-N-A-N, which is the Irish spelling, R-O-N-E-N, B-E-R-G-M-A-N. Fascinating figure, but it's good to see CNN interviewing him. That was excellent.
That was surprising. They'd have somebody like that on. But he's sort of well received in Israel too, though. See what I mean?
Well, that's right. I mean, a lot of this is, I think, defined by Israel. You know, a lot of the whether people appear or don't appear. I mean, this guy's obviously he's critical of his own government, and so there's no sniff of anti-Semitism, because this is what is used. Anyone that's critical of Israel is smeared by the Anti-Defamation.
Yeah, you pointed that out to me, and that was that's a good source right there. That's a good author on that book.
Anyway, do you want to talk about this shooting?
Oh yeah, well, you know, the FBI was given tips back in September and as recent as last month in January about this individual. Nicholas Cruz, and they spelled his name with a K in there, and I don't think there's three or four by that specific spelling in the country. So the FBI blew that big time. Now, why did they? I don't know. They're saying that it didn't get through their bureaucracy, you know.
Well, the FBI, I think, is a criminal organization.
Well, that's the problem with this, you know.
Exactly like the MI5 in Britain. Now, I'm not saying the whole, all FBI offices, all FBI agents are criminals. No, of course they're not. But what you've got is you've got criminal elements at the apex, you know, so at the very top. So, I mean, really, the MI5 in London, Thames House, just... very, you know, on the, right on the River Thames, on the North Bank, is exactly the equivalent of the FBI in the United States, and we have exactly the same symptoms with both organisations. What's happened is, with our terrorist attacks in the UK, is all of them, last year, we had three major attacks in Manchester and two in London, one in Manchester and two in London, and all of those individuals who led those attacks have all been reported to MI5 beforehand.
Right.
Manchester and London and the two London attacks have all been reported. You've also had this guy here in Florida having been reported. You have some similarities, maybe not so many, with the Las Vegas attack. But the fact is, I think we now have to start considering the possibility that when you report someone as a potential terrorist to the FBI or MI5, that they are then recruited as a terrorist by the FBI and MI5. In other words, they are encouraged into some sort of either entrapped or, I mean, who knows how exactly they would do it, but persuade them that they can get away with it for one reason or another, actually aid them. I mean, the FBI are particularly bad at doing this, which is where they actually give them explosives to potential terrorists. And most plots, terror plots in the United States, have been actually constructed by the FBI. The thinking behind it has not been being done by the individuals involved. It's actually been done by the FBI, and they've been attempting to entrap people and then arrest them and then put them through a trial as if it was all their idea. Well, it wasn't their idea. Almost every single case, it was the FBI's idea to do it in the first place.
Right.
Now, I mean, so we've got the similar sort of thing been going on over in the UK, George, exactly the same sort of thing. Someone phones in a report to the security services, MI5 in Britain, and then that person suddenly, for some reason, a few months later, turns up doing a terrorist attack.
Right. Well, you know, Todd Fletcher, I don't know if you know that name, he edited nine books on 9/11 for Griffin out in California. He and I both have come to the conclusion that we've got an American Gladio operation that's been underway for a number of years now. That's what this is about. See?
No, I think you're absolutely right. Of course, the agenda is exactly the same agenda as was played out in Las Vegas, which is gun control.
It's gun control and statism. Increase the power of the state, a national security state, accumulating more power, and gun control and elimination of all guns. That's where we're headed with this.
The idea that the state must have the monopoly on weapons. Well,
that's right.
I'm sorry, somebody like Robert Mueller should be behind bars. He shouldn't be deciding who can and cannot have weapons, and he shouldn't be making sure, you know, basically being in charge of a private army, whereas no one else in the United States is allowed to have any guns. Now, I mean, the thing is, obviously, if you take guns off people, then, you know, a civil war, should it happen, is going to be probably less bloody, but then that's not necessarily a good thing. You know, you actually, what you necessarily want is the use of guns as a deterrent to the government deciding it's going to have a civil war and taking on the population. I mean, we really are getting to that sort of stage in the US now. I mean, I don't think it's quite so close as in Britain, because we've got, quite
well. I came back with a counter argument with an individual one time. The way the Second Amendment reads is about a well-regulated militia and all that, gun rights and all that.
Yeah.
And then I came back with him and I said, he was trying to dismiss individual gun rights. Say, and I told him, okay, let's take a militia member that's on his way to a militia meeting of this well-regulated militia. and he has his gun with him, and he's attacked by someone. What does he do? He defends himself. So that's the personal, individual right to own and keep and bear arms. See what I mean?
Yeah, it's effectively the sort of family right of self-defense.
Right, but it gets back to natural rights, see? We naturally defend ourselves, see?
So the FBI were warned that the message posted on this guy's YouTube channel by the shooter, it seems, by the guy with exactly the same name, is, "I'm going to be a professional school shooter."
Yeah, that's
now,
him.
I would have thought that if I was an FBI officer, that person should certainly be interviewed, if not arrested, and certainly should be not able and allowed to be buying guns.
Yeah, we have statistics now coming out, information. With the deputy sheriff of that county, they visited that household that boy is a member of over a 7-year period 39 times. So he was really upset and unstable, the boy was. Then they fed him this psychotropic drugs, whatever it's on. That doesn't help either, see.
Exactly. And also, I've heard there's lots of sort of accusations against him. He was 19 years old. And there are people saying, oh, well, he hadn't had a girlfriend. Well, so what? You know, this is partly, I mean, it is part of the modern culture, is that you've got to, sort of be sexually active as soon as you're basically in your mid-teenage. I mean, you know, this is part of the culture that we're living in now. It's putting an immense amount of pressure on young men to become sexually active at the early
age. If you don't have a girlfriend and you're not making out with somebody, you ain't nothing. You're no nobody, right?
Well, that's part of the modern culture.
Yeah,
it's completely wrong. And so there may have been some sort of pressure on him in that direction. But I also wonder, and I saw some people tweeting about this yesterday, George, that a thorough examination needs to be made into whether he was addicted to violent shoot-em-up video games. Because this is another thing that, which I think is a really pernicious, dangerous...
I had occasion one year to sit outside one of those video stores when they had a special going on one of those shooter games. And they made it between 11 p.m. and midnight. You had to come in there and buy that video game, and you got it marked down to $79.95. There were 100 cars surrounding that game store. And they just they're addicted to those things.
Exactly. And you know what? The marketing of those games, although you and I will never see it, because this is the way it's marketed to the actual individual store
exactly.
owner.
Well, that night...
It's all about power.
Right.
So what it says on the... I've seen some of this marketing, George.
Right, that night,
on the
Tony.
Marketing, it says to your customers, this game will mean power.
Yes. Right? Now that night,
the idea is to sell it to people who feel powerless. Right?
That so night, the marketing was so powerful and effective. There was $600 million worth of those games. That game sold that night, just between 11 and 12.
The idea is that the game fulfilled
$600 million.
Power vacuum in people's souls.
So
people are feeling powerless. The idea is to target them with these violent shoot 'em up video games.
Right.
And on the marketing stuff I saw, George, it said, to your customers, this game will mean power. To you, it will mean dollars.
Right. And then they can be Darth Vader or something. I don't even play any of that at my age, of course.
No, of course not. I mean, nobody in their right mind does play these hideous games.
No, I played Pac-Man. Do you remember that, Pac-Man? Hey, I know one before that, Tony.
I used to play Space Invaders.
Hey, you did? Oh, you're a bad person. Hey, how about Pong? You remember Pong? Yeah, Pong was this deal that went back and forth like a tennis ball.
I think maybe that was the best game of all.
That was the best one. We played Pong in those beer joints, and then it went to Pac-Man after that.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, nowadays, these games, a lot of teenagers, particularly boys, are being targeted with these. So I think we're really, you know, I haven't seen any of the mainstream press look at this as a possibility. You know, they should be immediately looking at this kind of thing. because this is a completely new phenomenon, this idea of young men turning up and just shooting and shooting. And it's obvious that these kinds of games normalise that behaviour.
Yes, right? Yes, they do.
And also, they're targeted at young men who feel disempowered, whether that be because they're unemployed or whatever reason. So that also exacerbates, you know, young men's bad mental health is to feel purposeless and powerless in life. And these games can then come in and basically as a Trojan horse in their minds, in their lives, to turn them into killers. And, you know, I think maybe
if
there is a connection, the game company should be sued, you know.
When they go out and strike a school like this, it's a rebellious thing against the society at large. It's not right and it's evil, but it's a rebellious thing. I hate this world and the way it is and it's been treating me. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, I think it's all sorts of reasons why a young man might feel
rejected.
He's been with. Also, let's just remind everyone: there's 17 dead and 3 critical in hospital as a result of this. And I just hope that there's some proper.
What's that?
Because this whole business of FBI aided attacks like this, video game aided potentially attacks like this, has just got to stop.
Right, I know. Well, our young people, they're very naive and they're just caught up in the whole system. See, you know, when you're young like that, you don't understand. And you just don't go with the deal. You go with the deal, you know.
A minute, George, but I must mention the resignation of the Dutch Foreign Minister, sacking. The Dutch Foreign Minister, Halber Zijlstra, because this has hardly been reported in the British media and the TV, etc.
Yeah.
The reasons why he quit, because he quit after lying about a meeting with Putin. He said that he was at a meeting with Putin and he overheard Putin saying that he wanted to have a greater Russia and expand into Eastern Europe and take over Europe. And he just lied through his teeth, this Dutch foreign minister, because this conversation never happened. And the Russians basically were threatening to say, to basically call his bluff unless the guy resigned. So he had to be sacked. But my question is, what else have our politicians been lying about with regard to Russia and NATO? We've just had the British Defence Secretary, Gavin Williamson, saying that the Russians have been hacking into the British defence system, hacking elections. I mean, he's lying too. We know this is just simply not true. That the real hackers of the world are the people that run Skype, you know, and mess around with Skype when we're trying to talk on Skype. We're talking on the phone now. That lock me out of Skype, that hack into our computers. This is the National Security Agency, and it's GCHQ, our very own, that want to try and repress internal dissent.
Well, Tony, what they're trying to do is keep the United States and Russia apart, just like they did when JFK was alive. Because if the United States and Russia ever come together, then the New World Order and all of this deep state stuff is gone. And that's what they're afraid of. See what I mean?
Their days are numbered anyway, actually, because I think there's so many people now onto their game.
Yeah.
It's too late for them to actually win. They're going to have a go at it, but they're going to lose. I think that's the positive side to come out of all of this. There's probably a lot of blood will be spilled. But also, the support for Israel is becoming ridiculous. Look, we've got an extreme far-right government, the Likud party and Netanyahu. He's now saying that if you criticise Israel through joining the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement or making any comment in support of boycotting Israel, for whatever reason, even if it's a humanitarian reason, that Netanyahu is going to cut you off from all of your state rights. So say, for example, you're getting help with your housing, you're getting help with your food, that sort of thing, food stamps over in Israel, that sort of thing. Netanyahu is going to cut you off literally immediately. If you say something in public, tweet, Twitter or on social media, that is any Israeli supports the idea of boycotting Israel for political reasons in order to put pressure on them to stop the racism. So basically, if you speak out against racism, you will starve. That's effectively what Netanyahu is saying to anyone that's under the sort of mid-range poor over in Israel. And this is literally the Times of Israel reporting that this week.
Right. We've got
that's how racist they are. So they're not only racist, but they're saying that if you speak out against it, we're going to starve you. And they're saying that to the ordinary Israelis.
Yeah. This what about this Brexit? Is May just fudging around on that now? It looked like at the Davos meeting they're trying to undo that or something, or continue to keep England, UK in European Union.
Well, there's definitely an attempt to do that. I just don't think it's going to work, George. The other thing is we're going to get there's several things to say about Brexit. We're going to get hammered. Britain's going to be hammered financially. But that doesn't mean to say that the rest of Europe won't be either. Because I think quite a lot of the money is going to leave London. London may cease to be the world's financial centre. As a result, some of these big banks will leave. But then that might not be necessarily a bad thing. But given that most of them, like the big boys like HSBC, are actually criminal banks. So we can just wave goodbye to them, and this is what the comedian Mark Thomas has said in Britain, is, I mean, he's well worth looking up. He can be, I mean, he's quite acerbic. He might not necessarily be your brand of humour, George, but he's saying we will help the bankers to go. We'll actually drive you to Heathrow Airport. If you wish to leave, yeah, we will help you go. And that is probably going to happen. I don't honestly think that it's stoppable now. The other thing is that you're going to find the conservative elite in Britain using it as an excuse to clamp down more and more on the poor. So this is going to force matters between Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May, or whoever takes over to Theresa May. It's looking more likely that it will be either Boris Johnson to take over from May, or else Jacob Rees-Mogg, the possibility of two people to keep an eye on as replacements for her. Because she's clearly expendable. You know, she's got no personality. She could not win an election. No chance if there was a general election call. So she will be going. And the way the British system works is that the Conservative Party will decide for themselves who they want to replace her, which will probably be Rees-Mogg or whatever. But what I'm saying is that the Conservatives are really trying to consolidate their power and make sure that they don't have to pay any tax, hang on to their wealth, the poor will get poorer, and then we will have an almighty struggle to get a Jeremy Corbyn government or a similar-minded Labour government, which would be a very interesting thing to have once we've disconnected from the European Union, because it means that Britain can actually start to become an independent country again.
Yeah, I was reading an article on the Commonwealth of Nations and the Commonwealth realm and all that the other day, and they may not designate the Queen or her successor as the leader of the nations again. Did you notice that?
Well, I think there's an increasing disillusion with the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh and Prince Charles around the Commonwealth.
Right.
I would totally agree. And within Britain, because she is seen as greedy. She's seen as a tax dodger, and also she's seen as interfering in the democratic system. In other words, when a law comes along that she doesn't like, she just changes it.
Do you think William is more compatible with what's going on?
Definitely, yeah. I think William and Harry, the next generation.
Yeah, the next generation there.
Much more acceptable. And here's a path of this for a bit of speculation. Prince Charles is not going to be at all a popular head of state. In fact, he might try to become head of state in Britain and fail, right? But he would make, I think, a more appropriate leader of the European Union. So it might be that he could move in to become involved in European Union politics.
Right.
Anyway, I mean, he is, let's face it, his family is German, so he might feel more comfortable in Brussels than he would do in Buckingham Palace.
Right. We've got about 2 minutes left, Tony. What would be your concluding remark tonight if we've left out? I know we covered quite a few things.
We have. I mean, I think probably looking at the elites nowadays, we just have to understand that they are, I mean, let's just say something positive. So a lot of this is, you know, it's a bit depressing, a bit negative. The positive side here is that actually the fate of humanity is in humanity's hands. We seem to, I think, give a little bit too much credence, a little bit too much power to the people who we see on our TV screen telling us what to think. The fact of the matter is, that's just a screen. Quite a lot of people now are watching it and thinking, oh my goodness, Tony Blair is telling me something, the opposite must be true. So when I was brought up in the 1960s and 70s, we were told that this was the way things worked in Russia, that they could read between the lines. We've now got a whole generation of young people with access to the internet who have got a far better ability to use it than I have, or probably you too, George.
Right.
Who know that what they're being told on the on much of the mass media are lies.
Right.
And when a war comes along, they know that it's a lie, that it's been, I mean, this whole thing to do with Syria and chemical weapons. So I think what we're moving into a fascinating age where the fate of our all future generations are going to be decided by, really, by the opinions and by the thoughts of ordinary people. And whilst the elite will do their best to try and hang on to power, ultimately, inevitably, they're going to lose out, because we've got still got massive powerful forces in the world, most notably the Russians under Putin, who are simply not going to stand for any new world order, and actually they've got the ability to stop it. So we're not alone here in the West as ordinary individuals and alternative media people trying to get out the truth. We have actually got big forces in the world out there that are on a similar track to us and also want to see the greater success of humanity. So, you know, it's not as bad as it seems on the TV, George. Just switch off the TV for a little while, but do watch CNN.
Well, I agree with you, Tony.
It's like Bergman on there. It's definitely worth watching, and probably watch it on YouTube.
Yeah. It's like We the People Internet or We the People Web, you know what I mean?
Yep. The other thing to say just quickly is there's a search engine that I've started using other than Google, because people keep saying to me, what can we use? And it's called Search Me. The only thing, it's not spelled S-E-A-R-C-H, it's spelled S-E-A-R-X.me. And it's an excellent little search engine. I was first introduced to it about 10 days ago. Been using it on and off, and it seems very, very good. It's what they call a meta-crawler engine, which uses does searches on various different search engines, including Google, and gives you a real good spread of results. So make sure you bookmark that, and
I'll do that.
Start using it as an alternative to Google.
Okay, Tony, I certainly appreciate your conversation tonight. We covered a lot of ground. Okay?
God bless, George. Take
bless
care.
You. Have a good trip. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Be safe. Good night.